you something. I thought you were Dad. I was dreaming of him. He wanted me to go somewhere with him, and I told him I couldn't. Groping for the light, Benji turned it on. Norm turned it off. I don't want Duval in here, he whispered. Come on, I gotta talk to you. We'll go out this way. He started to remove the screen from the window. Benji said no. Norm said not to worry, he'd go first and help him down. He'd even catch him. Benji refused. It was too high, too dark, and besides, they'd be in big trouble if they got caught. Jesus Christ, Benji, will you have some balls for once? Why are you always so scared of everything? I'm not scared. I just don't want to get hurt, Benji whispered. All right, then we'll go out the door, he said as patiently as he could. But be quiet. Don't make any noise. He eased up from the bed. Why can't we talk here? Benji whispered. I don't want to go outside. He paused, sad at the thought that his brother's biggest fear might not be predators or the dark, but being alone with him. All right, we'll talk here. He sat back down and asked Benji about that first day that Duval had come. Did he run down the driveway like Louis said?
No.
Did he say anything about Negroes being after him?
No.
Did you see him before he came to the house that night?
No,
Benji said softly. You're lying. I know you are. I can tell.
Benji didn't say anything for a moment, then.
No, I'm not.
Benji, I don't get it. I can see lying to Stoner, but why to me? Duval already told Mom he knew those men. He says he doesn't want to get her mixed up in it. But it's more than that, and we both know it, don't we? Don't we? He said, squeezing his brother's arm, the bones sharp and alarmingly close to the skin. Benji, what if he killed that man? Doesn't that bother you? Doesn't it matter? Think of it. He might have killed a man, and he's in there right now next to Mom.
He didn't. I know he didn't, Benji said.
How? How do you know? Because he said he didn't? Alice is right. He's nothing but a liar. Everything he says and does is a lie. His whole life is a lie. You can't pick and choose with someone like that. He's dangerous, Benji. Can't you feel how evil he is? You saw how he turned on Alice. He uses people. He finds out what they're afraid of and the things they really want. I mean, I know. Jesus Christ, I went from despising the asshole to thinking he was the coolest guy I ever met. But it's all a game with him. He doesn't have real feelings for people. He's not normal.
But he loves Mom, Norm. He does, Benji insisted, his need for this as desperate as her muffled cries when she thought they were asleep.
Please, God, help me, she would beg. Oh, please help me.
All at once Norm shivered, not with cold, but with the rawness of flesh being stripped away, exposing every bone and organ to the clear night breeze.
Even if he does, that doesn't change anything, he said.
Well, nothing's going to make Early Jones alive again, Benji said.
And now Norm knew.
No, but there's a man in jail, and what if he dies for something he didn't do?
But maybe he did.
I don't think maybe's a good enough reason to die, do you?
But the police think he did it. Everyone thinks he did it.
Do you think Grandine Carson did it?
He waited. The only reply, Benji's breathing shallow through the dark.
No. You know he didn't do it, and you don't have the balls to do anything about it.
Norm moved closer.
But I do, little brother. I do.
Benji rode in back, his eyes darting between Omar and Norm in the front seat. It felt as if he'd been holding his breath for hours. His mother had made him come after Norm told her Chief Stoner would probably be back with more questions for him.
Why'd you say that?
He had asked Norm on their way to the car.
Because I'm going to prove something to you, Norm had said.
They were in Dairy Country now, a few miles past Albany. The farms they kept passing had their names posted on signs at the end of long roads that led to the gleaming main buildings. Large herds grazed behind the miles of neat fencing.
I never saw such big farms, Benji said, hoping to get a conversation going, but no one said anything.
Omar claimed he knew this area, but Benji could tell he didn't. Omar and Norm were snapping at each other again. Norm said they were just driving in circles now. They hadn't stopped anywhere yet, though they had left so early this morning that Omar hadn't even shaved. Benji had never seen Omar so nervous. And in spite of Norm's ominous talk last night of proving something, all he seemed intent on doing now was selling soap.
"How about here?" Norm asked, pointing to the farm ahead. "No, it's like the others. It's really a business. It's too big," Omar said.
"Then they'll buy more soap," Norm said.
"No," Omar snapped. "It's not the kind of business we want."
"Why?" Norm asked.
"Because I said so."
Omar stared over the wheel. Norm glanced back at Benji with raised eyebrows. A moment later, Omar smiled through the rearview mirror.
"How you doing back there?"
"Okay," he answered warily, folding a Presto pamphlet down to a thick square.
"Good. We don't want our newest trainee getting bored."
Omar's smile looked dry and forced. Norm put his arms on the seat back and turned around.
"You're not bored, are you, Benji?"
"No," he said, shrugging. He'd never been so tense in his life.
"How about Stoner last night? Jesus, next thing you know, he'll be coming to take everybody's fingerprints. I did a paper on that once, on fingerprints. Remember, Uncle Reenie knew some guy down the police station. He showed me how they do it."
He winked at Benji.
"You know those keys they found in the dead guy's pocket? I bet they get all kinds of prints off those."
He looked over at Omar.
"Hey, I hope those weren't your keys, Omar."
Benji watched Omar. Norm was making that up. There hadn't been anything in the paper about keys.
"They weren't," Omar said.
Omar had finally gotten them on a road with homes on it, though they were often 3 or 4 miles apart. The road ran along a river that curved out of sight now behind the tall trees. They were parked in front of a gray house that had a small red windmill spinning on its roof. Norm had gone inside with his sample bag. It was their third stop, and Benji was getting hungry. He could smell the Tootsie Roll Omar was chewing as he wrote on something in his lap. At least Omar's spirits were improving with each of Norm's sales.
"How come you don't like to use people's driveways?" Benji asked, again to fill the silence.
He sat forward, and Omar covered the paper in his lap. It was one of the checks Norm had given him.
"Because people don't like it," Omar said as he put the check into the glove compartment.
He locked it, then slipped the key into a slot in the visor.
"It oversteps the bounds," he continued,
gearing up for another of his heartfelt speeches, whose rambling logic began to relax Benji.
"The driveway is for the family's use. It's for invited guests. Businessmen like ourselves show we know our place when we park on the street. Like everything else in life, Benji, success starts with signs, the messages you send, which makes sense when you consider that half of life is illusion anyway."
He sighed.
"All those things you hope you'll do, all your dreams and promises and aspirations."
Omar turned, facing him.
"I don't know. Sometimes I think things are getting just too complicated. But then I remember our promise, each to the other."
Benji was conscious of the frantic horsefly hitting the glass in the trapped heat of the back window. Its buzzing came at him with the jagged urgency of Aunt Helen's doorbell. His father had called late last night after Norm had left his room. He had heard his mother whispering into the phone, "Sam, please don't. Please don't, Sam." After that, he had not slept. School started in a week. 8th grade. His chest hurt at the thought of it. Yesterday he had seen Jack Flaherty come out of the drugstore and light a cigarette. He was as big as Norm now, with a silky growth over his upper lip. In another week he'd probably be shaving. All the boys would be. He pictured himself coming into the classroom, past rows of girls with their huge breasts in pointed brassieres, and boys with menacing voices, shaving nicks and jock itch, while he grew thinner and shorter, his voice a wisp of girlish softness. Alice would be gone, and Norm would have little time or use for his cowardly brother. Everything was changing, everything but him. A wave of sadness swept through him.
"I keep worrying about that Klubok child, Benji. What exactly did you tell him?"
Omar asked over the seat. "Nothing," he said, recalling the day, the two of them sitting on the step in the dizzying bloom of sudden heat and blinding whiteness. This was the memory now, this flash, this image without details.
You didn't tell him anything?
No. He was just there that day. Omar's narrowing eyes seized his.
Where? Where was he?
On the back step. We were sitting there, he said, confused, until he realized Omar was afraid that Louis might have been in the woods with him.
Norm had come out of the house and was hurrying toward the car.
$4, he said, presenting the check to Omar.
Good job.
Omar tucked it into his breast pocket.
She didn't want to give me a check, but I said with cash I'd get in trouble. I told her my supervisor had light fingers.
Norm laughed.
I don't know where these brilliant ideas come from.
Omar had been staring at him.
Well, they're certainly coming fast and furious, aren't they now?
Pop, 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 Norm said, tapping his head. 1,000,000 miles an hour, faster than the speed of sound. It's a bird, it's a plane, but it ain't Superman,
Omar said, starting the car, and Benji laughed. Norm gave him a disgusted look. They drove around for a while looking for a place to eat, but there was nothing. They stopped at a gas station that consisted of one Tidal pump by a tiny cottage that had huge sunflowers growing to the roof line. When no one came, Omar honked his horn, and an old man in gray overalls and a golf cap rose sleepily from his rocking chair on the porch. Omar bought $2 worth of gas and asked to use the bathroom. The old man directed him to a shed behind the house. Omar got out of the car and removed his jacket, which he folded and laid over the seat.
Asshole, Norm muttered, watching him,
and the minute Omar was out of sight, he tried to open the glove compartment, but couldn't. He took the keys from the ignition, but none fit the lock. From here, Benji could see the bulge of the key in the visor. The fly was buzzing inside his head now.
You know what he does, don't you?
Norm said, searching through the pockets in Omar's jacket.
He changes the amounts on all the checks I give him.
He felt under the seat.
God damn it, I know he's doing it, but I need proof. It's the same thing he was doing with those three guys. I know it is. He's using me the same way he did them. He stays in the car, nobody ever sees him. Just me.
Norm looked back at him.
Nice, huh? I probably got police looking for me all over the place. What do you think of that?
Benji had been watching the man clean the windshield with a clean white rag.
Well?
He wouldn't do that. I know he wouldn't.
He is doing it. I know he is. I already saw one check he did it on. Jesus, Benji, you gotta believe me,
Norm said, turning to face him. The old man finished the windshield and was trying to get Norm's attention.
You better smarten up before it's too late.
Norm,
he said, pointing.
You want to do the inside?
The old man asked, offering the rag.
I'll point to the spots.
No, thanks, Norm said, and the old man started back to the porch.
Because we're probably not going to be in here for too much longer,
he said in a mock whisper, then laughed.
I won't anyway. Now that I know what's going on.
Nothing's going on, Norm, Benji blurted. He just doesn't want to get mixed up in that thing in the woods. He doesn't want Mom mixed up in it.
What thing in the woods? You mean the murder?
Benji nodded.
Well, say it then. Say the word, because that's what it is. It was a murder, Benji. A man died, and no matter what he says or how he tries to change it, he's involved. And that means Mom's involved, and I'm involved, and you're involved, and Alice, goddammit, every one of us. And that's what he wants. That's how he'll keep everyone's mouth shut. But we can get rid of him.
Here he comes,
Benji gasped as Omar came around the side of the house, buckling his belt. He stopped at the porch and paid the old man.
Look at you. You're scared of him. You're scared shitless.
No, I'm not.
I thought he was your hero.
Norm said, watching Omar.
I never said that.
The old man was pointing up the road.
Well, you like him, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
But you're scared of him, aren't you? You like him because you have to, don't you? Because if you stop liking him, you're afraid what he might do.
The buzzing was close behind his eyes now. He had protected Norm from Omar in the most fragile way by bartering the truth for his mother's happiness. And now his mother was not here, and he could not stop Norm, and he did not even possess the truth because he did not know what had happened that day in the woods. All he knew, all he would ever know, were the events as Omar had told them.
Well, don't worry. I'm going to get this asshole right where I want him,
Norm!
Just watch me.
Hello, my good men, Omar said, opening the door. I've just been told where we can get ourselves a lunch, but I'm afraid it's a half hour away.
Here the road was hilly and rose in steep curves. The recent rain had swirled gullies of sand into the soft shoulder. Below them to the right, the river was foamy and fast-moving. They had been on the road only a few minutes when at the crest of the hill they came to a drab green cinder-block building. The Schlitt sign over the front door said Mowgli's Cafe. There were two trucks and a motorcycle in the dusty parking lot.
Talk about luck, Omar said, pulling in.
I'll say,
Norm agreed as they got out of the car. Benji dragged after them. He didn't want to be here, especially in a place like this when all Norm wanted was trouble. There was no one inside.
How about the bar?
Omar asked, pausing by the empty tables.
Great idea, Norm said. Much faster service up here, he said, climbing onto a stool.
The door next to the beer cooler opened, and the bartender squinted out from the back room. Behind him, four men were playing cards in a fog of cigarette smoke.
Yeah?
The bartender asked.
We'd like some lunch, please,
Omar said, eagerly rubbing his hands.
Lunch? What do you mean, lunch?
The bartender said with a scowl.
Well, let's see.
Omar squinted up at the curled cardboard sign.
Hamburg, hot dog, grilled cheese, that kind of lunch. The sign's old. Well, whatever you got, then. I'm all out of the usual. All I got's pretzels, potato chips, pork rinds. Okay,
Omar said with a sporting nod.
Then that'll have to do for now. A bag of each, he said, laying his money on the counter. Oh, and two beers and a Coke.
The bartender peered at Norm, then looked at Omar.
How old's the kid? He's almost 9,
Omar started to say.
16, Norm said. I'm a little underage, sir.
The bartender let the door swing closed behind him. He put his hands on the bar and glared at Omar. They were the biggest hands Benji had ever seen.
What do you want?
The bartender growled.
You trying to set me up or something?
Absolutely not, Omar said, and Norm snickered.
What? You think I'm a shithead or something?
He glanced between Omar and Norm, and Benji held his breath. Omar had asked the old man for directions to the nearest bar. Their arrival here was deliberate, and Norm knew it.
Of course not,
Omar said, sliding off the stool.
Obviously the misunderstandings between me and the young man here.
Obviously, Norm said. He leaned over the bar. You see, it's me he thinks is a shithead. He thinks all it takes is a beer and I'll shut up and look the other way.
Come on, boy, let's get going now,
Omar growled.
Yeah, I'll be right with you,
Norm said, then turned back to the bartender.
Norm, Benji warned. You see, he's got this thing going, this crooked check.
Get out of here,
Omar snarled, yanking him so forcibly from the stool that it started to fall. Benji caught it and hurried after them as Omar steered Norm outside by the back of his shirt. Any minute now, Norm was going to explode.
Don't,
he wanted to shout.
Don't.
You don't know what you're doing, boy. You have no idea,
Omar panted. He opened the door and shoved Norm inside. Benji scrambled into the back seat. He sat there, shocked by the pleasure and exhilaration on Norm's face.
The trouble with you is you're too damn cynical, boy.
Omar glanced over his shoulder as he backed up, then pulled out of the parking lot, tires churning up a squall of dust and grit.
I like you. That's the only reason I wanted to buy you a beer. If I have any other reason, it's your mother, and I don't hide that fact, and you know it. She wants us to be friends, and I'm trying the best way I know how.
Norm continued smiling as the car sped up the steep incline. His grin widened as Omar declared his love for their mother and his desire to make her happy at any cost.
Whatever it takes,
he said so passionately that in the next moment's silence, he seemed to be weeping.
Do you understand?
He whispered.
Do you?
No, Norm chuckled. Not really. Because when she finds out what you're really doing, she's not going to be happy. She's going to be bullshit.
See, you don't understand,
Omar said, pulling the car to the side of the road. They were just over the rise.
You don't know what's going on. You don't know how it is between a man and a woman when they have complete faith and trust in one another.
Okay, Norm said, still smiling. Then let's just drive back and tell her. Let's see what she says.
Tell her what, Noam?
Omar asked, looking genuinely puzzled.
That in my campaign to make you like me, I maybe went a little overboard. Believe me, that's not going to be news to your mother.
He put his arm over the seat and patted Norm's shoulder.
That woman knows me like a book, like a well-worn, well-thumbed book.
He sighed, squeezing the back of Norm's neck. Benji could not take his eyes from the long, undulating fingers.
Get your hand off me, Norm snapped, jerking away.
I'm sorry, Norm. I didn't mean to make you feel... Well, that is, I didn't mean to arouse any troubling feelings.
You asshole, Norm cried. It's all over, Duval. I know what you're doing with those fucking checks, and I'm not going to be part of it anymore.
I think we need to talk, Noam,
Omar said, opening his door, his tone like his face, blank as stone.
And I think we need some air and some space.
Norm shot out of the car, and Benji's heart pounded as he started to follow.
Stay there,
Omar pointed at him.
This is between your brother and me.
No, he can come if he wants, Norm said. Come on.
No, I said stay there. Your brother and I are going to get a few things straightened out once and for all.
Come on, Benji, Norm insisted,
then flipped his hand in disgust when Benji closed the door. He watched them walk along the side of the road. They stopped once, and it seemed that Norm yelled something because Omar gestured as if to calm him down. They began to walk again. They grew smaller in the distance. Staring, he felt as if he were dreaming those receding figures as they made their way, passing in and out of shade and the dappled sunlight. There was a bend, a curve, and now they were gone. The road was empty, the only sound the rush of water from the river. With the perfect stillness came the certainty they would be friends again. It would be all right. Omar would calm Norm down. He would explain everything. He was the only one who could, because Benji did not know what he had seen, or if he had even seen anything that day. Whenever he tried to recall the scene, what they looked like, their words, their movements, it was always himself he was most aware of, the boy watching the boy as he peered through the slender willow branches. He got out of the car and climbed onto the front seat. He slipped the key from the slit in the visor and unlocked the glove compartment. There were two checks, each with today's date. Each had been changed. One was for $24 and one for $32. He put them back into the glove compartment and returned the key to the visor. He stood by the side of the car, looking ahead. They must still be talking. He would let them work it out. His patience would be as inexhaustible as his hope. If his father's sins were forgivable because he was weak, then so were Omar's. He got back into the car and laid his head back on the warm seat and tried to sleep. Later, when his eyes opened, he would sit perfectly still, struck by the sudden green depth around him. The river's rush would come at him in waves, in snatches of angry voices that terrified him, and he would close his eyes, listening as hard as he could. But then he would recognize the high, leafy commotion of cawing crows as they chased off a soaring red-tailed hawk. Norm and Omar had not gone far from the car, though it seemed so with all their stopping and starting and pacing back and forth. Nothing Omar said made sense or could satisfy Norm. Omar insisted he had not altered the checks. If this was so, Norm said, then why couldn't he see them? No, Omar said, because now it was a matter of principle, of trust.
That's the way life has to work,
Omar added, as if Norm had questioned this, too. As he spoke, he snapped off the tip of a birch branch and tore off the small silvery leaves one by one without looking.
A man's word. It's his most precious currency. And believe me when I tell you, I do not give mine cheaply.
Norm had just noticed a pale blue piece of paper sticking out of Omar's shirt pocket.
The choice is yours, he said, throwing down the stripped branch. You either believe me or you don't.
I don't, Norm said, staring at him.
Then there's nothing more to say,
Omar said glumly.
I guess not, he agreed.
Your mother's not going to like this, Norm.
There's a lot she's not going to like, he said.
There you go again, Omar said with a quick toss of his head, as if shaking himself dry. Threatening me. Look, Norm, understand something here. Your mother knows everything about me, past, present, and future. She knows everything about this business, and she knows I'd sooner die than cheat someone out of their hard-earned...
Omar's mouth gaped open as Norm slipped the folded check from his pocket.
Very good job, Omar.
He couldn't help laughing. A $4 check was now a $14 check.
Jesus, you can't even tell. I'm impressed. I really am. Same ink, just like the old lady's handwriting.
A look of fatigue and sadness washed over Omar. His shoulders slumped with his deep sigh.
You shouldn't have done that.
I wish you hadn't. So that's why we always had to sell so far from home, he said, looking at the check again.
Margaret Winstead. How many others now hated the thought of him? How many times had they described him to the police? What did they say? Such a clean-cut boy? I told him he reminded me of my son, my grandson, my nephew.
And we never went back to the same place twice, did we?
You don't understand, Omar said.
Yes, I do. Really.
He turned and started to walk away.
Noam, Omar called. You know I did this all for your mother. You know that. It was because of her. My God, why else would I do it?
Probably for the same reason you did it before with those Negroes. For the money, he said, exaggerating each word.
No. No, that's what gave me the idea. When I read that in the paper, I swear.
Jesus. If that's the best you can do, I gotta go. I'm not that stupid. You can either give us a ride or we'll thumb.
He walked on a few more feet.
All right, Norm. All right.
Omar ran up beside him.
I didn't want to have to tell you, but your mother's involved in this. She knows all about it.
You liar! You no good!
He spun around.
She does, I swear. In fact, she was the one. She begged me to do it. You know how she got the money for the business? She was so desperate she forged your Uncle Reenie's name on the loan documents. I couldn't believe she'd done that, Norm. She came out of the bank and told me, and I was shocked. I said, Marie, you can go to jail for less than that. But it was done. It was too late. All we can do now is get that loan paid off as fast as possible before anyone discovers the fraud she has perpetrated. You got to help me, Norm. Please, all I'm trying to do here is help your mother. I love her. I'd do anything for her, anything.
The rest of what he said was lost in the squawking of the crows that circled overhead and the rasping surge of the river.
You no good son of a bitch,
Norm cried, lunging so suddenly that Omar lost his footing, and the two of them grappled and fell, skidding down the steep stony embankment until they were only a few feet from the fast-moving river.
Don't say another word about her, you hear me? Not another goddamn word, you no good.
Norm was on top of him now. Omar grunted and struggled, his eyes bulging with terror as Norm slapped his face so hard and relentlessly that it came as a great relief to see him bleed. He could stop this. He was strong. He did have power. He did. More power and guts than any of the rest of them. His mother, his sister, brother, father. The blood splattered from Omar's nose with every blow. Never again would he be made a fool of. Never again by anyone. Never again. Never again. Never.
Norm! Norm! Norm!
Came a high-pitched scream. Thinking it was her, his mother, he would not turn around.
Good. Let her see it. Let her see what she'd failed to do. Let her see what he had to do because he loved them all too damn much.
Pebbles skittered down the hillside. It was Benji trying to get down to him. Poor, scared Benji. Well, there was nothing to be scared of anymore.
Norm!
Benji cried as Omar managed to push Norm far enough away so that he could get to his hands and knees. Then, rising to his feet, he scrambled to stand up. Norm lurched forward just as Omar swung. The blow of his forearm hurtled Norm in a backward stagger down to the river's stony edge. Omar kept walking toward Norm. Though Omar's back was to him, Benji could see the sudden glint in Omar's right hand, the blade at that instant released.
Norm! Norm! Norm!
He was screaming as he ran down the hill. Falling twice, he continued to skid down on his bottom, advancing himself with digging heels and clawing fingertips. They were in the water now. Norm had lost his footing on the wet rocks and was down on one knee. Omar stood over him, gesturing as if unaware of the knife in his hand. Even as Benji got closer, they still seemed to be a great distance away. Though he knew exactly who they were, he kept expecting to see the others, Early and the watching boy. He crept closer. He looked around for the boy, but there was no one to keep him safe now that he had come this close, close enough to see the streaks of mud on Omar's wet shirt, the darker wet cuffs of his pants, so close he could hear the hideous wheeze of his labored breathing. Norm lunged again, and this time grabbed Omar's arm, and the two of them locked arms in the same struggle, the same grunting struggle he had seen before. Omar was grappling with Early. Omar was choking Norm. Omar had killed Early, just as he would kill Norm.
"My brother! My brother! My brother!"
he panted. They were knee-deep in the running water. Omar's face was red with smeared blood. There was blood on Norm's arm and chin. Omar was behind Norm with one arm around his neck, while he held the knife edge at Norm's throat, backing him deeper into the river.
"No!"
Benji screamed.
"Don't, Omar! Please don't hurt him! Stop! Wait! Just wait!"
The minute he stepped into the river, the icy water stiffened his ankles. Omar continued to back away.
"If you don't stop, I'll get the police! I'll get them right now!"
he warned, turning as if to go. But Omar kept backing Norm in, deeper and deeper. The water was at their thighs. With Omar's forearm bracing his chin, Norm could not speak. He stared wildly back at Benji, who had picked up a rock and was wading deeper into the water that was suddenly at his crotch. He thrashed toward them, slowed now by the strong current. When he reached them, the water was over his waist. Omar and Norm were both grunting. He got behind Omar and began to pound the rock into Omar's back, but he didn't seem to feel it. Stepping away, he hurled the rock at Omar's head, but it missed and sank into the water. Omar wrenched himself and Norm around. Omar was sobbing. Norm's eyes were huge with shock and fear. Seeing Benji now, he stopped struggling.
"Help me, Benji," Omar sobbed. "Help me. I just want your mother to be happy. You know that. That's all you want too, right? I did what you wanted. I tried to keep this from happening. You asked me, and I promised I would, right?"
"Let go of him,"
Benji said, his eye on a short, thick branch that was bobbing toward them.
"I can't,"
Omar said.
"He'll ruin everything for us. You know he will."
"Let go of him,"
Benji panted, stepping into the path of the floating branch.
"I have this wonderful plan," Omar said. "Your mother would be the happiest woman in the world, but I need your help."
Benji took another step. He tripped, and water bubbled at his nose and mouth, choking him. He rose, gasping and flailing his arms.
"Be careful,"
Omar was shouting.
"Don't move, Benji. It's deep here, over your head, and you'll drown. You know you will."
The branch was coming. He reached out, but it was going to be too far wide of him. Omar must have thought he was trying to save himself with the branch, because just then he pushed it closer, and Benji caught it with both hands. He kept stumbling and going under as he tried to get closer to them.
"Careful, Benji," Omar pleaded. "Get back."
"Let go of him,"
Benji screamed as he swung the club-like branch right into Omar's face. He staggered and Norm pulled free. But now Omar jumped at him. They were fighting in the deeper water. Omar raised the knife and Benji brought the club back again, this time smashing it into his elbow. The knife flew into the air, and in its brief trajectory from hand to water, he knew without doubt it was the same knife he had seen protruding from Early's bloated chest. The water churned with thrashing arms as Norm pummeled Omar, who was trying to get away. Benji waded closer, and he swung the club at Omar's back. Omar had managed to get into the shallow water. With one last surge, he pushed Norm away, then was out of the river and scrambling up the hill with both brothers after him.
"You bastard! You no-good son of a bitch! You better run, you no-good bastard!"
they screamed.
"You asshole!"
When they got to the top of the embankment, they saw him running down the road. They chased after him, but he had made it to the car. He got inside, and they picked up rocks and hurled them one after another, banging off the roof and the hood, and then the powerful engine roared on. As Omar sped past them, they were still throwing rocks and cursing.
"Look at that!" Norm yelled. "The no-good bastard's laughing!"
It wasn't laughter, Benji saw, but Omar looking right at him and sobbing. They trudged down the road, dripping wet, their own breathlessness sounding at times like crying. Exhausted, they carried their heavy wet sneakers and their shirts, their raw red eyes stinging in the hot sun.
"The crazy bastard was going to kill us both," Norm said,
hobbling over the sharp stones in the road. Benji limped alongside. "Yeah," he said, though he did not yet mean it, because in such acuteness, such aliveness as this, there was no death or possibility of it. There was not any pain in Howard Menke's leg as he carried the bucket across the church lawn. The only time he ever limped now was in Josiah's presence. He set the bucket in the grass at the base of the Virgin Mary. He squeezed his rag in the soapy water and began to scrub the pale marble, gently working the rag into the grimy crevices of her eyes and lips until they gleamed. Her chest was hardest to clean because of the gown's shirred folds. So accustomed was Howard to this chore that he gave her round breasts and hips little thought at all. In fact, there was so much on his mind today that he as easily might have been scrubbing the mailbox as the Holy Mother of God. Grandine Carson was out of jail. He wanted to sell the pig farm and move to Florida with Josiah, but she had told him last night that she couldn't go. Her brother needed her. When Carson offered to have Howard come too, she said that would never work. Howard hated new things too much. Howard had been listening at his bedroom door when Carson came and knocked on it. At first he had pretended to be asleep when Carson called in and asked him to go for a ride in his pickup so they could talk man to man. But then he thought of all the bad things that might happen if he stayed in there. The worst would have been Josiah going for a ride with him and changing her mind. He could tell she was nervous when they left, but no matter what Carson said, he never weakened. Nothing, not a room in their trailer or the promise of his own, would change his mind. Actually, he would have lived anywhere to be with Josiah, but she was afraid of the pig man now. The police could search for Omar Duval until the end of time, but she would never feel safe with a man who not only had been accused of murder, but had shot her own brother. Besides, Helen LaChance had promised to double Josiah's pay if she'd come back, an offer Josiah was considering now that Sam Vermoyle was going away again.
"Good morning, Howard," called Father Reardon as he came softly along the path.
The shy young curate was not having an easy time of it with the Monsignor, who wanted him to be more forceful and outgoing. Yesterday, Howard had overheard the Monsignor talking on the phone to the bishop about Father O'Reardon's whisper.
"People are always asking, 'What did he say?'" the Monsignor complained. "I have to read his lips."
"That's a fine job you're doing, Howard,"
the new priest said as Howard drew his rag up and down the marble bodice. Even with his back turned, Howard had no problem hearing him.
"Splendid statue. An exquisite work of art, isn't it?"
The priest sighed.
"The sculptor has certainly captured the essence of the Blessed Mother's spirit."
A pool of dirty water was forming around Mary's feet, leaving slivers of dirt between her toes. As the priest continued to talk, Howard scrubbed. It was time to rinse, but he was trapped here.
"She is a beautiful, beautiful woman, don't you think?" Father O'Reardon said with a sigh.
As soon as he was gone, Howard turned on the hose and began to rinse the statue. Water ran down her cheeks and gown. As he walked round the statue, spraying it from side to side, he realized just how beautiful she was, tall as Josiah, with the same long fingers and slender feet. He tried to imagine what Josiah might be doing right now. When he'd left this morning, she was taking all of the infant's clothes out to wash them. She was probably ironing them now, and then she would fold and wrap them in tissue paper before putting them back in their bureau. From the corner of his eye, he saw the Vermoyles' front door open. Sam Vermoyle came out first. He looked away from the bright sun. At the bottom of the steps, he raised his head and tugged at his shirt collar. Next came Renee LaChance. Both men wore suits and ties, but Sam's suit was baggy and the pants were short on him. They got into Renee's new car and drove away. Howard and Josiah were going to see Perda next Saturday. He had already started planning their lunch and collecting presents for everyone in the ward. but he felt bad because Josiah never wanted to talk about the trip. He turned off the hose. There was still grime in the hem of Mary's gown. As he scrubbed, his fingers lingered on her cold, wet toes, and his eyes widened with happiness, because he knew once they were on that bus, Josiah would get right into the swing of things again. They had packed the car last night so the morning would be calm. Alice was still up in her room. She was nervous, and Marie was determined that nothing would go wrong on her first day of college. Marie had baked a loaf of banana bread last night and mended her skirt. She didn't know what mothers were supposed to wear when they took their child to college. "Whatever you want," Alice said every time she asked. So in the end, she had settled on her brown work skirt and a new navy blue sweater that didn't really go with the skirt, but it had been marked way down. Mr. Briscoe had given her the day off, but she was going to make up the time on Sunday. Losing a day's pay would be a disaster right now. It would be good to get out of town for a few hours, away from all the stares and whispering that Marie Fermoyle had taken up with a con man and murderer. Chief Stoner had come every night for the past week, asking such asinine questions that last night she wouldn't let him inside. "Please," he had said, adding quickly, "I mean, if you don't mind, it won't take much time." She did mind. She didn't want to talk about Omar Duval anymore. She had told him as much as she could. She hoped they never found him, because she didn't want him back here. She didn't want the ordeal of a trial. She never wanted to see the man again as long as she lived.
"I can understand that," Sonny had said, "especially when you've been so close to someone like that."
"We had a business arrangement," she had said, drawing herself up so stiffly that her neck still ached.
"Of course,"
he had said, too quickly, his face reddening in a way that confused her.
"Alice," she called now from the bottom of the stairs, "come down and eat."
Marie didn't want her last breakfast here rushed. Everything in these last 24 hours had been too tinged with finality. The dry cough from Alice's bedroom in the middle of the night, the scent of shampoo and baby powder drifting by the door, the ratcheting squeak of the ironing board as she set it up in her bedroom.
"Alice,"
she called again, then suddenly buried her face in her hands, whispering,
"Oh, God, help me, help me, help me."
What was wrong? She had been looking forward to this day for months, for years, and suddenly she was terrified.
"Alice, can you hear me?"
"It will be like this," she thought, listening for footsteps or her voice and hearing nothing.
Soon enough there would be days and nights, long after they had gone, when she would do this, call out for one of them, then listen, knowing full well no one would come. But she would have the satisfaction of their strength and their success. That would make it all worthwhile. Yes, she vowed, that would be enough. Klubach's puppy began to bark. A car was pulling into the driveway. "God damn that, Sonny," she muttered, hurrying into the kitchen. Well, this was it. From now on, if he wanted to talk, he could call.
"Hello, Marie,"
Sam said when she opened the door.
"I just wanted to say goodbye to Alice."
His face was a shocking red, his cheeks and the bridge of his nose mottled with blistery broken blood vessels. His thin, yellow-tinged hand trembled as he held out a small white box tied with red ribbon.
"This is for her."
From the next step down, Renee grinned up at the two of them.
"You should have called," she said. "We're running late as it is."
"Well, I was going to."
He swallowed hard and shook his head, and in the old way of knowing, she understood how for days he had wanted to, planned to, tried to, but then could not bring himself to even lift the phone, much less make the commitment.
"We just thought we'd stop," Renee explained, "on our way to Waterbury. I'm riding Sam up. He's going to stay a while. The state hospital. He called and made himself all the arrangements,"
Renee said with a proud nod at Sam, whose modest grin saddened and wearied her.
"We can only stay a minute," Renee said. "Sam's got a 9 o'clock appointment."
She invited them in, and they sat at the table. Renee couldn't stop smiling.
"That there Bendix is quite a machine,"
she heard him telling Sam as she hurried up to get Alice. "She'd be down when she was ready," she called from her room, and at her sovereign tone, Marie's hand shot to the doorknob. No, she would be patient. Today there would be no outbursts. She came down and sat at the table with them. Renee's eyes gleamed as he ate banana bread and bragged about the store.
Mr. Cushing was turning the entire second floor over to Reenie's housewares department. A lot of the old managers were jealous, but Mr. Cushing said they were all a bunch of crones and Reenie wasn't to worry because it was time for new blood and new ideas.
"And that's one good thing about me. I always have new ideas," Reenie was saying.
Sam drank a glassful of water. He kept glancing up at the clock. There were sores on his mouth and his knuckles were scabbed. She tried not to look at the pulsing blue vein in his right temple. Cushing's was already planning their Christmas promotion.
"A winter wonderland of value,"
Reenie said, eating the crumbs from his napkin. He helped himself to a third slice. Sam was biting his lip. He kept taking deep breaths, then gulping when he tried to swallow.
"There's going to be a Santa Claus on every floor, and not only that, but out in the parking lot, real reindeer. Well, for the opening day, that is. That's going to be really something. You ever seen a real reindeer?"
he asked Marie. "Well, yes. Deer there all around the woods." She didn't dare look at Sam.
"Oh," Reenie nodded. "Oh, yeah, that's right. Reindeer, they're like deer the same, huh? I don't know. I was thinking they weren't really real, I guess, because of Rudolph and Santa Claus."
She and Sam looked at each other.
"Ain't he something?" Sam said, chuckling. "That's why I'm on my way to the nut house. Reenie. He finally did it. He pushed me over the edge." "No, now tell her the real reason, Sam."
Reenie smiled at her.
"Sam's made up his mind. He doesn't ever want to drink again, and this time he means it."
"That's right," Sam said with his wry half-smile. "This time I mean it. Not like last time or the time before that or all those other times."
He was looking at her.
"Believe me, this time I mean it."
He closed his eyes and laughed.
"Oh, do I ever."
She studied a jagged hangnail.
"I think that's great. Just great."
Reenie patted Sam's shoulder.
"Don't you?"
he asked. But she had gotten up to see what was keeping Alice. She ran upstairs again and opened the door. Alice was sitting on her bed reading a book. She was dressed in her new olive-green corduroy dress. "What are you doing?" And the minute she said it, she knew the answer. "He has to leave. He only has a few minutes." "I'll be right down," Alice said without looking up. "Tell him I'm almost ready." Sam and Reenie had said goodbye and were on their way out the door when Alice finally came downstairs.
"Oh, don't you look beautiful," Reenie said, holding out his arms when he saw her, then quickly hugged himself.
"I wanted to say goodbye, pet, and wish you good luck," Sam said.
He handed her the box.
"She's gonna love him,"
Reenie told Marie as Alice opened the box. "Thank you," Alice said with a nervous little laugh. "They're beautiful."
"Look close," Reenie said, reaching to take the fountain pen from the box. "See on this hook thing here? It's got your initials, AMF, in that old English. Both pens got it. Real classy, huh?"
"Yes," Alice smiled at him. "Thank you, Uncle Reenie."
"Oh, don't thank me. Thank your dad here. He's the one giving you such a nice present. Me, I'm only the driver here."
Alice smiled.
"That's the truth," Reenie said. "I mean the truth. The truth."
"Ah, she knows, Reenie,"
Sam said with a sad chuckle.
"My little girl knows all about me, don't you, pet?"
He pulled her close and hugged her, looking over her head at Marie.
"I just want you to know how proud I am. I'm so proud of you," he said, looking at Marie, who stared back at him.
Marie had taken two wrong turns and ended up 10 miles from campus. "What time is it?" she asked again. 11:20, Alice said. "Oh, God!" She drove so fast the car began to shimmy. Alice's dorm was on Redstone campus, about a mile from the main campus. The circular road was backed up, so they waited in the long line of idling cars. Ahead, in front of the dorms, mothers and fathers were unloading their station wagons, carrying in suitcases and trunks. Boxes, pictures, and bulletin boards were stacked on the walkways. Alice's things were in grocery bags, which Marie thought would be easier to manage than boxes. She hadn't considered all these people seeing them carrying in paper bags. "Two gypsies, that's what we'll look like," she muttered, but Alice didn't say anything. The line was moving ahead. Alice had mentioned a trunk, but Marie had said no, and now she could see that everyone had trunks. Damn it, Why did she always give in so easily? If she wanted a trunk, why not make sure she got one? If she couldn't pull something as simple as that off, how the hell was she going to make it on her own?
There's no place to park, Alice said as they inched closer to the dorms.
That's because we're late, damn it. You should have come right down when I told you your father was there.
We're not late.
Oh, okay. Then why can't we find a parking spot?
Because they all got here early, Alice said, her eyes darting at everyone.
Story of my life, Marie sighed. A day late and a dollar short. She drummed her fingers on the steering wheel.
Alice stared out the window. I don't believe it. I'm the only one in a dress.
Well, don't blame me. That was your decision.
I know that, Mom. I'm not blaming you, Alice said, glancing at her.
The bottleneck was caused by a large panel truck parked in front of the second dorm. It blocked part of the narrow road.
God,
Marie said, as a car ahead stopped and all four doors flew open. Four girls jumped out, and instead of waiting for a parking space, they ran around to unload the trunk. Marie watched a group of women greeting one another on the sidewalk.
Look at all the mothers. They're all so dressed up.
She felt drab and small and sweaty.
No, they're not. They're just...
Alice's voice trailed off.
Just better dressed than you,
Marie completed the thought.
In bright colors, soft and pretty swishy skirts, with husbands to do the hauling and lifting.
The girls slammed the empty trunk shut and the car pulled out. The two cars directly ahead parked at either side, one on the left and one on the right, leaving just a narrow passage between them.
Look, they're twins, Alice said, pointing to two redheads. Each was unloading a car.
There's a spot, Alice pointed to a blue car that was pulling out from behind the panel truck. Marie eased ahead, trying to inch between the cars. Staring blindly ahead, she didn't dare look to either side, making her way on hope and the certainty that nothing could happen now, not when she had come this far, gotten this close.
Hey, lady,
someone called, and she hit the brake. They both jerked forward, and Alice groaned.
What do you think you're doing?
A burly young man called from one of the parked cars.
You're not going to make it.
Then why don't you move? It's not fair to block everything just because you've got two cars.
Mom,
Alice said.
It's not my fault, the young man said. It's that joker up there with a truck. He's taking up all the spaces.
Mom, why can't we just wait?
Alice hissed, her pinched white fearfulness the prod Marie needed. No. Alice had better learn right here and now that waiting never got anyone anywhere. Besides, now all she wanted was to get out of here as soon as possible. There were too many people watching, and behind them the line of cars was growing longer.
I can make it.
The engine was idling so fast that just lifting her foot from the brake bucked the car forward.
No, you can't,
the young man insisted, and she hit the brake, jerking them again. He angled his head to see.
One more inch and you'll hit my fender.
Neither of the cars flanking her could be moved. The one on the left abutted a stone wall, and the one on the right was against the curb.
Mom, please,
Alice groaned, eyes wide, fists clenched in her lap.
Everyone's looking. Why are you doing this to me? I feel like such a fool. I can't even breathe.
She couldn't back up, and she couldn't go forward, and she couldn't even open the door to get out. Somewhere in the long line behind them, a car blared its horn. The young man hurried in a half-trot toward the entrance to the circle, where he directed each car to back up. Up ahead, the door of the truck opened. The driver jumped out and was walking toward them with a bouquet of roses.
I don't believe it,
Alice said in a low voice. It was Blue Mooney in dark green coveralls. He waited on the sidewalk while Marie backed up, and the car on the right pulled partially onto the sidewalk to let her by.
This isn't happening, Alice said. I know it isn't. Any minute now I'm going to wake up.
When Marie parked behind the truck, Mooney opened Alice's door.
Happy first day of college,
he said, handing her the roses. Their fragrance filled the car. Alice seemed to bury her face in them.
Moving in day, right? So I brought my crew,
he said with a wave toward an unshaven man in a soiled undershirt that did not cover his hairy belly, and a tall, skinny, tattooed fellow with cigarettes behind both ears. They nodded, and the tall fellow waved good-naturedly.
Hello, Mrs. Vermoyle,
Luke called in.
You and Alice don't have to lift a finger. All we need's the room number.
He squatted down with his hands over the door, grinning at her. That's awfully nice of you, but people don't do that, Alice said softly.
I know, but I just thought you'd like it. You know, kind of classy having your own crew, moving in day and you got your own crew,
he said as if she weren't getting it. He gave a high, uneasy laugh. With her silence, he winced.
But it's weird, huh?
He glanced back at the families hurrying in and out of the dorms.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Them two can go get a coffee, and I'll unload you myself like I'm your big brother or something, without the monkey suit even, he said, unfastening his top button.
That's a good idea, Marie started to say. With his help, they'd have this over in no time, and then she'd be on her way. Maybe she'd even get in a few hours at the store. No, that's okay, Blue. Really. It's one of those things, you know, you just do with your mother. What I mean is, I always looked forward to this. I always pictured us doing this together. She even took the day off so we could do it, she said, gesturing back at Marie.
Yeah, I did, Marie said, pleased to hear Alice finally acknowledge her effort in getting the time off. But I'm going to make it up tomorrow, she added, though no one was listening. Hey, Blue said, cocking his finger at them. I get it. It's a family thing, right?
Yeah, Alice said, and then she thanked him for the roses. They're beautiful, she said.
You really like them? For a minute, I didn't know if that was weird, too. I kept looking around, but nobody else has any bouquets.
Alice laughed. No, just me. I'm the luckiest one here.
Hey, he said, taking a step back. I'll tell you what. I'll come by one of these nights and we'll go for a ride.
He laughed.
And I promise, no truck and no crew. I'll come dressed like a real college guy.
He looked around.
Yeah, I'll get some of those, what do you call them, those shorts?
Bermudas, she said under her breath as he strutted toward the truck on his high-heeled boots. She laughed nervously as he drove off. They got out of the car and opened the trunk. He was just trying to be nice, Marie said.
I know,
Alice said, taking out two bags.
Well, it wouldn't hurt to have someone like that around if you need help.
If I need help, Alice said, as they carried the bags up the front walk, I'll just call you, Mom. She had been to the freshman parents' meeting in the chapel while Alice registered at the Waterman building. Tuition, she said, when Alice asked what the meeting had been about. She didn't tell her that moments after sitting down in the warm back pew with the dust-moted sunlight streaming through the tall leaded windows, she had fallen sound asleep, not waking until a man nudged her so he could get by. Now there was the picnic on the green. Since they hadn't thought to bring a blanket, they stood under one of the graceful elms with their fruit punch and chicken salad sandwiches.
We're the only ones standing, Alice said.
No, we're not.
Yes, we are. Come on, we can sit on the grass.
Alice started to sit down. No, I don't feel like it. I want to stand. She had just realized that they were the only two women who were alone. What she wanted to do was leave. She hated things like this, hated all the false camaraderie and cheer.
That doesn't make any sense, Alice said, getting up and leaning against the tree. Why do we have to be the only ones standing?
Well, why don't you put your beanie on then, like everyone else?
What's a beanie got to do with whether we stand up or sit down? Alice asked.
Well, you want to be so different. You don't want to be like everyone else, so we might as well just stand.
There, she thought, relieved to have found some logic, some basis for this baffling rage. Alice smiled with wide, apprehensive eyes.
I'm not trying to be different, Mom. I just think it's weird, that's all. But if you want me to wear one, then I will.
She removed the beanie from her orientation packet and put it on. She smiled and tilted her head as if posing.
Now can we sit down?
Seeing the green felt beanie perched on Alice's head made her feel worse. She had dreamed of this day, focused every effort toward this moment, and now all she felt was this terrible emptiness. Would anything ever be enough? As soon as they sat down, Marie noticed a white-haired couple and a thin girl with glasses who were sitting nearby on a red tartan blanket.
What are they looking at?
She hissed.
Shh, Alice said. They're obviously talking about us. Come on, Mom, let's just eat.
Marie glanced down at her sweater. All her buttons were fastened.
What do they keep looking at? Mom, please, you're so nervous and now you're making me nervous.
I'm not nervous.
The girl got up and came over to ask if Marie and Alice would like to join her and her family.
Thank you, Alice said, immediately getting up. That's so nice.
Marie looked at her, then rose slowly. She was relieved to see what mousy little people they were. Grandparents, Marie thought as they introduced themselves. Maybe the girls' parents were dead or divorced, or maybe just plain lousy low-life people and this cheery but plain couple were trying to fill the gap. As it turned out, Jean's parents were an army family stationed in Germany, and the grandparents had driven up with her from their home in Virginia. Both girls seemed relieved to be in each other's company. Neither one had yet met her roommate. As it turned out, they were both on Redstone campus, but in different dorms. From there, they walked together to the concert in the chapel. Jean and Alice strolled along in front while Marie bombarded the grandparents with a flurry of nervous questions so that they would have no time to ask any of her. When they got inside, she hung back to let them get ahead, but Alice hadn't noticed and ended up sitting with Jean and her grandparents. Marie slipped into the familiar back pew, pinching her wrist and jiggling her foot to stay awake as the university string quartet played the Four Seasons, which she thought was the saddest music she had ever heard. By the end, her eyes stung with tears, and she bit her lip and tasted blood. What was happening? Hadn't she looked forward to this day for years? Yes, here they were. This was their start, their new beginning, the university president was telling them from the pulpit. Then what was this overwhelming dread, like a huge black wave that hung in the air, ready to swamp her? Her thoughts began to race. My God, Sam, Omar, what poor choices she had made in her life. There was a hole in her shoe and a small yellow bleach stain on the hem of her dreary skirt. Norm's last year of high school, and then there would be two of them in college. And how would she ever pay for that? Benji would be alone. She would be alone. Alone. Always alone, with a garage full of soap and an ancient car. One more major car repair would ruin her. But what did they know or care? No, nobody cared. Not really. Not Sam, not her own children. In this whole world, not one person cared what happened to her. She had tried too hard, worked too much, and now she had nothing. She didn't belong here, and everyone knew it. They could hear her pounding heart. They could feel her trembling limbs. She had to get out before something terrible happened. She excused herself along the row of angled knees and hurried outside. A few minutes later, everyone streamed through the doors, and Alice rushed down to her.
"I didn't know where you were," she cried, linking arms. "I never went to a concert before. Wasn't it beautiful? Jean said they have them every Friday night. She plays the violin. She's going to try out for the orchestra."
She stiffened, wanting, needing to pull away, but did not until they crossed the street. Then she extricated herself, gently, so that Alice might not notice.
"I'd love to play an instrument," Alice said as they walked toward Redstone campus. "That must be so wonderful."
"I'm sorry, but I couldn't afford the lessons," Marie said in a low, clipped voice. There were parents and their children all around them.
"I know that, Mom. That's not what I meant. But anyway, Jean said I could take lessons here."
It was too late, and this was her fault, too. There were certain things children had to be given early, and if deprived, they would never catch up. She knew this, but did not say it. The last event was the dorm reception, tea and cookies with Alice's house mother. She told Alice she had a headache, and if she left now, she could beat the traffic. Alice begged her to come, even if she only stayed 5 minutes.
"But I hate tea," she said, hesitating at the door Alice was holding open for her. "Then don't drink it," Alice said. "I just want you to be with me."
The house mother's sitting room was packed with weary parents and their bright-eyed daughters. Alice led her straight to Miss Grady, the house mother, in pearls and a pale blue suit, who stood next to the silver tea service.
"This is my mother," Alice said.
"I'm Rosemary Grady," she said as they shook hands. She paused expectantly. "It's so nice to meet you."
"Nice to meet you, too," Marie said, confused, but certain that something had been overlooked.
"I didn't get your name," Miss Grady said softly.
"Fermoyle," Marie said, stiffening. "We have the same last name."
Did the house mother think because she was divorced, their last names would be different?
"I meant your first name."
"Marie."
"Alice looks like you, Marie," she said.
"Well, I hope not now, but a younger version of me, maybe, before all the wrinkles and bags set in," she said, in an attempt at modesty, graciousness, wit,
anything but the inanity she saw reflected in Miss Grady's polite smile.
"You probably already know this," Miss Grady said, turning to Alice, "but for my money, you have one of the best rooms in the whole dorm."
"Really? Actually, it looked so small compared to the others," Alice said, and Marie glared at her.
"The thing is, it's right next to the kitchen and the lounge, so it always seems like a little apartment set up to the girls who live there. Rosemary!"
Miss Grady turned to greet a tall, slim man and his blonde wife, whose older daughter had lived in this dorm 4 years earlier. "When you introduce me," Marie hissed, "you're supposed to say my name."
"I forgot."
"And don't be complaining about your room."
"I wasn't complaining," Alice whispered.
"You said it was too small."
"Mom, please."
"Well, you don't want to be like your Aunt Helen, do you? Always negative, always complaining."
"Mom, please. Not now, not with all these people around."
"It's important to get off on the right foot with people."
"Mom, stop it. You're a nervous wreck. Your mouth is twitching."
Alice touched her own mouth.
"Please, Mom."
"I want to go," she hissed. "I have to." There was no air in here. Everyone had someone to talk to. She had nothing in common with these people, who were probably all college graduates themselves.
"No, not yet. You can't. Come on over here," Alice said, leading her to a small wooden chair in the far corner of the room. "I'll get you some water."
Alice was on her way back with the water when her roommate, Laura Morgan, arrived with her parents, Marilyn and George. They were late because one of their cows had had a difficult delivery. Laura, who wanted to be a veterinarian, had assisted in the early morning birth.
"At one point, I think George had both arms in up to his elbows," the mother said, and George nodded. Miserably, Marie could tell, knowing just how out of place he felt.
Clearly, this was the last place George wanted to be, perched on the edge of a fancy love seat, his shiny dark suit pants hiked up over short white socks. Laura brought her father a plate of cookies, which he was devouring.
"Poor thing, he hasn't eaten since last night," she said, patting his head.
Full-busted and short, with muscular arms and legs, Laura was built like her mother, who had just come back from the truck with 3 blackberry pies, one for Miss Grady and 2 for the girls on first, as Marilyn now called the 10 girls on Alice's wing. Marilyn had a faint mustache, and she wore a hand-knit yellow sweater over her thin cotton house dress that snapped up the front. She wore wide black flats, no stockings, and she had a laugh like a roaring bonfire. Astonished that so many of these Vermont girls had never spent a day on a farm, Marilyn was making plans to drive down to campus in 3 weeks and fill the truck with anyone who wanted to come for the weekend.
"By that time," Marilyn promised with her arm around Alice, who still held Marie's glass of water, "the girls on first will be just dying for some home cooking."
me too," Miss Grady called, waving her hand as the girls and their parents laughed. George was pouring tea from his saucer back into his china cup. Marie watched Alice's widening smile, and she realized that she was smiling too. Now that she was on her way home, she could think straight. Alone, she was starting to feel calm again. She envied Alice this new life, this opportunity to be anything and anyone she wanted to be. If she gave them nothing else, she could give them this. Their future was all that mattered. It was all she wanted. There would be no more misplaced hope. Never again would she wait for a man to save her. Omar was gone, leaving her with all that soap and a bank payment she would have to scrimp and scrape to cover from month to month for a long time to come. The worst of it was everyone knowing how weak and foolish and vulnerable she had been. Pathetic, really. So desperate for love that she ignored the obvious signs. But then, she hadn't been the only one, had she? Harvey Klubach and so many others had also fallen for his promises. A few more miles and she'd be home. It was 5:30. Right now, Alice was probably eating her first meal in the cafeteria. Tonight there'd be a dance. Maybe she'd meet a nice boy, someone who would love her forever. She would have loved Sam forever, but now all she dared feel was pity. As long as she lived, she would never trust or have faith in him. The sun was behind the trees. It would be an early winter. Each night came cooler than the night before, with the leaves on the trees already starting to turn. Now there were mostly yellows. Soon the hills and mountainsides would be aflame with red and gold. There would be the long nights, the long darkness, the first snow, all the dead earth. And when her children left, she would be alone. She drove along Main Street. It was a good feeling to be almost home. The closer she got, the stronger she felt. The air seemed clearer. She would tell Mr. Briscoe she could do Astrid's work as well as her own for whatever Astrid's salary had been. Maybe Sam was finally ready. Reenie might be right. This was the first time he had ever hospitalized himself. Maybe now, with the kids older, he would feel less pressured by life. Maybe if he only worked part-time, there would be less stress. If Mr. Briscoe did pay her more, and if Sam could work part-time, and, of course, there would be the Formoyle house and the three tenements when Bridget died, then maybe... What was she doing? No. She would not doom herself to such tenuous hope. She would do what she had always done. She would rely on the one person she could trust, herself. She turned the corner, driving a little faster than usual. She couldn't wait to get home to her boys. Maybe they'd all go to a movie tonight. When was the last time they'd done that? She couldn't remember. This is how it would go, she thought with a burst of expectation and joy. She would move from moment to moment. She would make her way gradually. Because she was strong, they would succeed. It was all she wanted. By the force of her will, she would keep them safe. She peered over the wheel, bewildered by the activity at the end of the street. There were wheelbarrows in the road in front of her house. There was a woman kneeling on the corner of her lawn, a man pushing a roller out of her driveway. There were people everywhere. They were her neighbors. There were two ladders leaning against the front of her house, three on the driveway side. Harvey Klubach was on one of them, Norm on another, Bill Costello, Jim Wilbur, Cyrus Branch. They were all painting her house. Dick Fossey's married son knelt on her roof as he nailed shingles around the chimney. Her front lawn had been dug up, smoothed and seeded. Straight lines of lime were disappearing as the sprinkler waved back and forth, settling dust and soaking the dirt. Jesse Klubach came around the back of the house with a tray full of paper cups. "They have no right," she thought. "Who said they could do this?" Benji and Lewis were dragging boards out of the garage. Nelson Hammond was on top of the garage, pushing a roll of tar paper over a new section of roof. She couldn't turn around and leave. She had no choice but to pull into the driveway. She sat in the car, trapped, stunned, as they turned, looked down, came from around corners, stood up to see her. "They have no right." Trembling, she opened the door.
"Mom! Marie!
Surprise!"
"Surprise, Marie!"
Grinning, they came toward her, bearing hammers, saws, shovels, brushes, these strangers she had lived among for 10 years and did not know, did not like, or want to know, or want to like, much less be now beholden to, as much the object of their pity as she had been of their scorn all these years, 10 years of looking the other way, pretending not to see or care or hear.
Hypocrites, all of them, sanctimonious hypocrites.
"What do you think? Hope you like it so far."
"What do you mean, so far? We're almost done." Laughter. How dare they? Who did they think they were? What gave them the right to intrude in her life like this? She walked slowly. She would not pass out. Her ears were ringing and she was dizzy, but she would not grant them this final satisfaction.
"We wanted to do this," Jesse said, hurrying alongside her to the back door. "We all got together. We just wanted to lend a hand."
But they had no right. Who gave them the right to turn her life into an occasion of public charity?
"Please go home," she said. "Just go home and leave me alone."
"Mom," Norm said, touching her arm, his soiled face so close to hers she could smell his earthy sweat.
"Everyone's been so nice. They just want to help, Mom, that's all."
"Thank you," she said in a small voice that could be heard now only because the yard, the valley, the universe had grown perfectly, dreadfully still. "But I don't need anyone's help, and I don't want anyone's help, so please just go."
She stepped into the kitchen and closed the door, then stood there with her hands over her face.
"No," Norm said outside. "She doesn't mean it. I know she doesn't. She's just not used to this. She doesn't know what to do."
The door opened, and Jesse Klubach came inside.
"Marie,"
she said, touching her shoulder, then petting, stroking her as if she were some dumb creature.
"It's okay, Marie. We just wanted to do this. We just wanted to do something."
But she had nothing to give back. Nothing.
"That's okay, honey," Jesse said, as if she could read her thoughts. "You just have a good hard cry now. I know just how you feel," she said,
then tiptoed outside,
closing the door softly behind her. The kitchen wall rumbled as a ladder was being climbed. There was hammering on the far side of the house, the eastern side, where the woods began and ran for miles to the mountain that always brought the earliest light. The smell of fresh paint pervaded the house. Outside, the murmurous voices rose and fell.
Alone, she kept thinking. Alone, alone, alone.
Then suddenly, she burst into teary laughter and could not stop.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Songs in Ordinary Time by Mary McGarry Morris. Copyright 1995 by Mary McGarry Morris. Read by Sandra Burr. Directed by J.C. Howe. Engineered by Kim King. Performance copyright 1997 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.